My name is Maria, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Giroux, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Stanley will read the preamble.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Stanley and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that cannot change, the courage to change the things that can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Kenny will read the traditions.
Steps. Read the steps.
Yep.
Hi, my name's Kenny, and I'm an alcoholic. How you doing? Step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our... Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will and for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Ray Ann will read the traditions.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Ray Ann Cook, a grateful recovering alcoholic. The traditions. Step is not a step. Tradition one. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority. A loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Tradition 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Tradition 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation for all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Dev.
Hi, I'm Dev, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of this group. I have a sponsor named Scott K, who also has a sponsor. And I'm extremely nervous. I've been dreading this for the past 2 weeks. I'm not extremely grateful to be here. I started drinking like a normal high school kid when I was 16. My first drink, I think I was 8 years old at my aunt's wedding. And I didn't get drunk. I don't think I got drunk. I remember wanting to appear drunk. My cousin got drunk. He was about 12, and it looked like a mature thing to do. But I do always remember, before I took a drink, feeling extremely insecure and uncomfortable, at odds with everything and everyone I came into contact with, and just different, where no one else was. After I got drunk for the first time at 16, so between 8 and 16, I didn't get plastered. But after 16, I sort of drank normally with my friends on the weekends, dabbled in other stuff fairly frequently, which eventually led to aggressive drinking in college. And in college, it's hard. A lot of people, for the newcomer in here, specifically the newcomer who's in his or her teens or in his or her 20s and is just graduating from college or still in college, it's hard to sometimes distinguish yourself as an alcoholic in contrast to all the other people who are also drinking. I grew up in a house of recovery. My mom's been sober for 21 years. And she gave me that whole lecture, like, you know, you've got 85% chance you're going to go down the same road I went down. And so that sort of freaked me out. And it made me a lot more cautious than anyone else I was friends with, which I had a real resentment for that when I first came into AA, because I felt like it was harder for me to shake that denial that a lot of us come in with, because I had just been had such denial while I was drinking, despite blacking out most of the time, needing it like a fish needs water, just feeling like it was the only reason to live. Everything that I did in a day was a means to getting a drink, and it was just a desperate feeling constantly until, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock, when I was allowed to let loose. And I sort of noticed, I really noticed that no one else was like that. I could tell by the way people drank, the pace at which they drank, the way they acted when they were sober, that they didn't have something they didn't have the thing that I had. And then when I drank, it was very clear. So coming in, I was very resistant. I didn't like the thought of being like my mom or like many people in my family. And I came in and it was just not appealing to me to not drink ever again. And it seemed silly, to be completely abstinent. Didn't seem like there was a point to it. I really didn't want to stop drinking. Some people come in and I think they do want to stop. You know, they've gotten beaten down enough where they've had enough. And I didn't feel that way at first. I did feel beaten down, but I felt like I needed to drink. I was still young and everyone else was drinking. It didn't seem fair. I wrote some notes on my hand. So I lived most of my life, with blinders on either side of my face, usually in a cold sweat, with some mission in front of me that I didn't really know what it was, but I was always frantic and terrified. Walking down the street was a chore. Being outside where people could see me was very difficult. So you can imagine walking into this meeting with, 3 days of sobriety wasn't a picnic. But I sort of knew after being here long enough and hearing the stories, I started to relate to that feeling of needing more, not only more of alcohol, but just more of everything. With me, it's food, candy. You know, the only difference between alcohol and those things is those don't make me black out and do regrettable things. But I realized I was just so depressed when I came in, and I think it was a matter of months before I started seeing changes. When I first came in, I was having panic attacks every day, to the point where I was convinced I was dying. I had an incredible resentment for anyone I saw who didn't smile at me and give me some sort of positive reinforcement. I still get that now, but it's fleeting, and I have the tools to just scrape it off. There's no way I'd be able to get up here. I mean, you can see, or some of you can see how nervous I am with, 2 years and some change. But when I came in here, it would have been, I would have passed out immediately. I almost did just walking through the doors. But over the course of those 2 years, I've learned serenity. I had no idea that was an option for me. I thought I was just destined to be a sweaty, trembling mess for my entire life, at least during the daytime, and then, early evening, I would have that freedom. And it's just not the case anymore. Over time, I can't say it in the next 3 minutes, but over time, something happens and that stuff is lifted. You do what they tell you, that you do what your sponsor tells you. You get a sponsor. You come to meetings. You start noticing when you start thinking and doing things that you used to do when you were drinking, and you immediately use the tools they give you to remedy those actions and those thoughts. And it's just so much less hard to live now. It was really painful. For some reason, I have a very depressive personality, and I thought, even though alcohol is an aggressive depressant, that it would, if I drank enough of it, it would get rid of that feeling. And I don't have that depression anymore. And it's not for any reason other than the fact that I joined this program. I can say that with confidence. And to the newcomers, if it hurts and if it's painful and boring and you're restless and you want to leave right now because you hate to sit still, then you're feeling the right feelings. It's not meant to feel good, and it'll start feeling better, and then it'll feel kind of bad again, and then it'll feel even better. And over time, you'll just start to live a normal, healthy life. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Dolores.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Dolores Beaufort, and I am an alcoholic. Let's see, where shall I start? Years ago, I went to school, and I took a course on alcoholism, and I learned that I was an alcoholic in my head, not my heart. And I went to a meeting, and then I went back to the meeting, and I asked for help. And they said, here's a lady's number, call her. And I called her, and she said, can I meet you at 60th Street and Park? And I said, yes, I could. And that was March 19, 1986. As you all know, the group went one way. I went my way. I came back when I had 14 years. What I would like to share with you this evening is that in my experience, strength, and hope as a AG member, what has happened to me. From 202 to 208, I lost 7 members of my family. And I'd like to share with you this evening how you helped me stay sober. You don't know that. I would come in here and I would sit back there and I would just sit. And the person who is now my grand sponsor would say, just get it in. You know, just the ambiance, the noise, the excitement, seeing who's doing the big book, all that stuff. Just take it in and it kept me sober. So I will tell you about my journey. I have a young lady here. All of these people, I want you to know, have much less time than I do. My present sponsor has less time than I do. My grand sponsor has less time than I do. I have these people in my life because I have a character defect. And that character defect is laziness. I don't want to work. But anyone who has stayed here long enough will tell you that don't take a drink and go to a meeting. It will not get you sober. No, it may get you sober, but it will not keep you sober, and it will not keep you sane. So when I first started here, what happened is I went to the Wednesday night meeting. And I met a young lady, and about 6-7 months later, whatever, she said, you need to come down to the Sunday night group. And I said, you must be out of your mind. I live in the Bronx, you know, and this is October, November, cold. But my sober feet said, go ahead. And so I went. And I met up with a young lady there who's doing the literature. And then I met another young lady. Now, this young lady who's doing the literature helped me learn to be a chairperson of the literature. She also took me to Rackers Island. Isn't that amazing? And then I met another young lady who said, we do the intergroup. That lady is now my grand sponsor, and I held up my calendar and I said, I can't go that Wednesday, that Saturday. She said, no, but you can go that Saturday. Now, who's ever listening, you'll notice no one said suggested that you do so-and-so. No one has ever suggested anything to me. By the way, Peggy's here. I forgot to get on her. Let me get on her while I'm at it. You know, I came and I said, hello, Peggy. And she said, that's nice, dear. You know how Peggy is. So then my then sponsor came and she introduced me, and that was all right. So I'm standing over there minding my own business, and guess what Peggy says? Why don't I see you doing service? She did not say, may I suggest to you, Dolores, that you do some service. She did not say that. Okay? No suggestions. Okay? So, no suggestion. So then I got a friend who's here with me tonight, became buddies, and I was talking about her sponsor. Now, going from one sponsor to the other, many people talk about this, so I'd like to share this with you. I had my sponsor for about 20 years. And in all due respect to her, her sobriety has been it's been really chaotic. She has not been happy, joyous, and free. I won't share her story, but it's been very, very difficult. Peggy knows her. Peggy knew her sponsor. But when I came here, she came down and she spoke at the Sunday meeting. And what she did is she made sure I was all right. And she met my friends, the ones at the literature table, the one that was dragging me to Rackers Island. She said, "You'll be okay." She was really saying goodbye because she had to go on. But in the meantime, I used to sit with this young lady all the time. I said, "Well, who's your sponsor?" And she said, "So-and-so's my sponsor. Patty S. is my sponsor. Helen T. is my grand sponsor. Pam is my sister. Chris, who is Helen T.'s sponsee, is my telephone buddy." So I have a family. They keep me sober. They keep me on my toes, more than likely. And so I asked Patty S. to be my sponsor. And I was down at Intergroup. She was down at Intergroup, and she said, a whole 5 minutes, she said, "Why, you know, what can I do for you?" And I said, "I'm lazy. I'm really lazy." So I will tell you all, and I really thank you so much for my sobriety. As I said, I am a blackout drinker. I tried to kill a man in a blackout. I tried to hit him with a frying pan twice. I only know once. It was an iron skillet, and if it had to hit him, I wouldn't be standing here. It's called murder or something like that. I drank Gypsy Rose and Pepsi Cola, which is, most people don't know what that is. But I had to put the Pepsi Cola in because it was terrible. But the whole idea is that I'm an alcoholic and I had to drink no matter what. Why did I drink? Because it hurt. The emotional pain that I was in really, really hurt. So all I wanted to do was sleep. By the grace of God, I was able to raise my children and do all the other things. But I have been very, very, very blessed. Am I still lazy? Yes, I am. But with my family, they give me this push that I need. One of the things I learned while I was in college was that I had a black male teacher teaching me alcoholism. And he said one day, "We're going to have a white male atheist come in and teach us about the spirituality of the program." And I sat in the classroom with my big self, Roman Catholic that I am, a practicing one, said, "Oh, this is ridiculous. This man doesn't know either." Today, I am very, very happy that man came into that room. He said something like, Shakespeare says that the world is a stage and he's on it. In other words, he was just part of the world. Even though he did not believe in God, he believed in those words, and it used to be on 449, my third edition. And that I carry with me. I thank you. So to me, AA can teach me many things. Young people can teach me many things. I live in the Bronx, and I go to a meeting up at 321. It's a treatment center. And I go in there, and I sit. You know why? Because they tell me about good stories, falling down, got drunk, the police, and it keeps me sober. It reminds me that, Dolores, with your 24 years, if you ever pick up a drink, you will be one of them or worse. What else do I want to say? I want, you know, you're nervous, you're so nervous, and you say so much that. So this program is a highly spirit, it's a spiritual program. It is a highly spirit, it is not a religious one, and that I can do. I wanted to talk about also a man that's in here. I want to talk about two more people. There, I went to the Friday night group, and the Friday night group had a man come, and he took out the book, Language of the Heart. And I have more time than this man. Thank you for looking up. I won't say your name. That man taught me about what was more in language in the heart than I ever knew. My sponsees who have over 20 years, thank you. Because I was able to go back to them and say, this is what I have learned, and that they appreciate it. I want to tell you who took me through the big book. I had been here 14 years. I knew. I was taught to listen to learn, learn to listen, take the cotton out of my ears, put it in my mouth, don't analyze, utilize. And yet I found out that I did not know half of what was in that big book. I had no idea. That young lady, I have 14 more years than she does. So for me, and I think it will always be, it is not how much sobriety you have, It is the quality of the sobriety you have, and to me, that's very important. THINK means for me. Thank heaven I now know that I have a disease that I can arrest one day at a time, and I thank you, AG, for my sobriety.
Our main speaker tonight is Joe.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the Atlantic Group for inviting me to share my experience, strength, and hope. In the next 25 minutes or so, you'll know more about my life than most people who've known me a long time. I'm trying. Okay. I was born into an alcoholic family. My only recollection as a child of family gatherings were people drinking, aunts and uncles. It was the end of World War II. I was a little kid. My uncles would be coming back from Italy, from Africa. They'd have medals, guns, flags. They'd always have that smell, you know, that later on I realized it was booze, you know. And they would check in with their sister, my mother, who was nicknamed Saint Loretta, and my father was known as Poor Mickey. You can tell who was the alcoholic and who was the Al-Anonic. St. Loretta went to Mass and Communion every single day. When we were little kids, in the worst blizzard in New York City, she packed up three little kids and went to church. 3 months later, she was dead from cancer. And I knew at that moment that God didn't really care for me. And I just shut down as a little kid. I was popular, but I didn't feel like I fit in or belonged. The sun stopped shining from the time I was 7 years of age. And God left us with, one of the aunts said, God needed your mother. And I thought, well, what about us, you know? Because I knew that our alcoholic father, who would disappear for days, and he couldn't take care of us. He did try eventually do the best he could. And from that point on, my brother and I grew up separately from an older sister. I romanticized my father's alcoholism. I said that he died of a broken heart. He loved our mother, and he just drank himself to death. The last time I saw him alive, my brother and I, we did not have a home from the time I was 8 years of age on. We lived with five different families. We knew all kinds of neglect and abuse, and the last time I saw him, he had a convulsion, and they took him away. And 3 months after that, the phone call came in, and I knew it meant that he died. And he died an alcoholic death, cirrhosis of the liver, and throat cancer. I loved him, and I hated him. And I already knew at 15 years of age not to feel, not to trust, not to love. And a lot of alcoholics, you know, when a lady's friend spoke about the pain, you know, I just buried all those feelings of grief and loss and anger and resentments. Speaking to the microphone. Can we lower this a bit? Yeah. And thank you. Great. And that was not me. It was the microphone. Now, this tale called My Story did not cause my alcoholism. I've known adult children of the alcoholic households that had far worse stories and never drank. I have a gene, I think, that once I pick up a drink, I want to drink another one. And at 15 years of age, at my father's wake, I walked into a bar, and the baton of alcoholism passed from one generation to the next. I drank to get drunk. I loved it. I thought it was the greatest thing. It took away all that feeling of being self-conscious, and I just was fun at the bar. At least I thought I was. And I immediately a new vocabulary. As long as I could walk, I wasn't drunk. The first time I had a blackout, I was stunned because I couldn't figure out how I got from this bar to my bed miles away without remembering how I got there. And that all went away when I went to the bar the next night and asked my friends how we do that sort of sheepish, you know, quite a night last night, wasn't it? And they reminded me, you know, that I pulled up the car between the door of the bar and the canopy so nobody could get out at 3 o'clock. I would do anything for a dare. My 18th birthday, I celebrated in Havana, Cuba, the last days of the Batista regime. I lasted 2 weeks drinking unlabeled rum that burnt a hole in my stomach. By the time I got back to New York City, I had to go to a doctor, and he asked me the question after they tested me. He said, "How much do you drink?" And I said, "I drink socially." And he said those prophetic words, "Then cut it out." I already knew that I needed alcohol to live. You could not live the life that I was living without alcohol. I was always willing to pay the price, the pain, the hangovers, the guilt, the remorse. I thought that was the only way to live my life. I didn't think I'd make it to my 30th birthday. I nearly accomplished that. I was thrown out of, well, two schools I left. The third one I was escorted out by New York City detectives. So I never finished high school. I was always on the verge of, I was in trouble, about to get into worse trouble. And somehow I would turn and escape disasters. But it eventually caught up with me, and one aspect, it was like Dickens, my life. I inherited a considerable amount of money when I was 19. And so I retired. I moved into Manhattan, three blocks north here. I used to say Park and 63rd. It was 63rd and Park, but it sounded better. And I drank in better bars, the Harwin Club, the Copa. Same behavior, just nicer toilets. That's about it. And somewhere along the line, I started running out of money. I applied to university, and I was accepted. When alcoholics make up their mind to accomplish something, self-will run riot applied there, and they accepted me. So I went from feeling stupid, because they left me back in the second grade after my mother died. I carried that resentment towards a nun from the second grade for 40 years. Alcoholics know how to carry, Irish alcoholics particularly know how to carry resentments for generations, forget about decades. I was accepted at university and I got a job in the garment center, and when the man said, "You know, the more you sell, the more we'll pay you." And I couldn't believe that. Like, they were going to pay me a commission. And within 5 years, I was the sales manager of the company, the youngest sales manager and in the industry. And drinking every night. And some people describe alcoholism as a desperate search for spirituality, for that connection. Some of my hangovers would drive me into churches, and I would just yell out, "If you're here, help me," you know, because the pain was so severe. And I wound up approaching the owners of the company and telling them what I had done for them, reminding them how successful I made them, and I outlined my plan. It sounded like Napoleon ready to take Russia on. They were like amazed that my 5-year plan, and I told them my conditions. And the conditions was I would run the factories, I would be the president of the company, they would make me a shareholder, and I told them the salary they would pay me, and I would use that to buy into the ownership. And they came back about 4 days later and they said, "This is alcoholism, and it's I was 25 years old. They said, we'll triple your salary. We'll make you president of the company. We cannot make you. We talked to our wives. We cannot make you a shareholder. And we can't run the, can't let you run the factories, which I had never been in. arrogance, defiance, insanity. I looked at them and I said, gentlemen, that's a compromise and I'm not interested. And I walked out. To their dismay, and to later on my regret. But I continued to drink. I didn't have a job. I wound up severely hemorrhaging, for those of you who haven't had your dinner yet, in my sister's apartment. It was Thanksgiving, and I knew I was dying. When blood passes through both ends of your body, like The Exorcist, you know it's your time is up. And here's where the higher power came in. My friend Wes, who died from this disease, had a car downstairs. He was ringing the buzzer. They took me to University Hospital, and while waiting for Dr. Locallio, who saved my life, a priest came in, and I was on the telephone. I was as white as the sheet. I lost a lot of blood. And he said, I said, yeah, Father, with my best Jimmy Cagney impersonation. And he said, I'm here to give you last rites. And I looked at him like I was going to buy an insurance policy, you know, getting on an airplane. And I said, you know, come on in. And I remember that look, you know, how they look at alcoholics, non-alcoholics, you know, that dismay. And that night they removed 75% of my stomach. And they shot me up with a lot of morphine. The night nurse was a friend of mine. And she was reading me the OR report. And the next day, in the door, Mackie walked in, this little 5'6" Irish ex-prize fighter, weightlifter, counterman, soon to be found out, recovering alcoholic. Came into my room. He had a carton of cigarettes. He was smiling. You've seen the picture of the two men standing at bedside. Well, it was Mackie sitting there telling me his life story. He told me he was an alcoholic, that he was in AA. I never thought I was an alcoholic. I'm dying from it. I was too successful. I was too cool. You know, I'll beat this, you know, whatever. And he took me to my first meeting. At that meeting, he told me, the first time we met, he said, my real name is not McDonald, it's Walsh. I thought, who the hell changes their name from McDonald to Walsh? From Walsh to McDonald. And he said, I'm wanted for manslaughter. If they ever catch me, they'll put me, because I was doing an act of war. And he told me, he confided in that. And he lived out his life. He was sober 33 years. My two sons are here tonight. The last few years of his life, he was our chauffeur. He worked for us. He lived in our house. I wanted my sons to know Mackie. He lived out his life under an assumed name, and he stayed sober through everything. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous and to Mackie's introduction. So when you're sitting here, the newcomers tonight, you're in a very privileged space, because most alcoholics never get to where you are tonight, sitting here. And you have an opportunity to live a fuller, richer life. You know? The gift is recovery. You know? And I started going to AA meetings. I didn't think I never got drunk from the first drink. I tested that. I wound up in a client's home. I had one client. I insulted his wife, his taste, her taste, their values. I thought it was good for them to hear it from Joe. They were very prominent people in the industry and their community, and no one else was going to talk to him and set him straight. I did that night. It was the only client I had. And I went back the next day to AA, and I stayed sober for many, many years. Recovery begins with the first step. Every alcoholic has to reach a bottom. And the magic words, I need help. I can't do this anymore. I asked for my higher power. I called out, God help me. I didn't believe in God. I didn't trust God. You know, but I knew that I needed help. So I started going to meetings. And I always say, if I can get sober, anybody can get sober. Because for at least 2 years, I couldn't read a paragraph in the New York Times. I was mocus. I didn't know if it was Tuesday or Thursday. I dressed up. I didn't have any money. I went broke in AA. I was in the mustard seed. I couldn't believe that I completed a whole year. I was like thrilled. And I turned to some guy next to me. And he said, how's it going, Joe? I said, it's fantastic. I've had a year and I didn't drink. And he said, great. He said, everything else? I said, well, there's one problem. I'm going totally broke. And he said, have you asked your higher power for help? And I said, you can do that? I couldn't believe that you could ask for a fuller, richer life. What a gift, just that I didn't have to drink, you know. And that night I got on, I had gotten a job working in a different industry, which I'm into this very day. And I got on my knees and I said, if you want me in this business, show me how to put a deal together. And a month later, I announced the first deal, and it's like an oil well. It's been going ever since. I'm doing something wrong. Speak into the microphone. Okay, sorry. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah? Yes, they can. So, the steps. At the mustard seed in the beginning, I knew the second step applied to those people who came to us from mental hospitals. Did not apply to me. I was never going to do a fourth step because you're not going to write down the stuff that I did because somebody could read it. Anyway, so I went right to the 12th step. I was sponsoring guys left and right. I only took on the hard cases. Other people were married, had families. My spiritual quest had begun, but I didn't realize it. One night outside the mustard seed, a man named Bob, who became my sponsor, was explaining to me recovery, the dynamic process of recovery. And while he was talking to me, it was a cold autumn night, this creature approached us, and Bob looked at him and he said, Brownie, it's pretty tough out there, isn't it? And I was like shocked. I thought, I could all of a sudden see underneath that filth, I could see these eyes. And I recognized that Bob was talking to Brownie with the same respect that he was talking to me, the great Joe D. And Brownie was dead within 6 months. But I remember that left an impression. And that night, I turned to Bob and I said, why are you doing this? He said, what do you mean? I said, you got a family. Why are you doing this? Because I knew there was nothing that he wanted from me. And he said, oh. He said, that's in order to keep it, I got to give it away. It was one of those statements that didn't make any sense to me in the beginning. In order to keep this, we have to share it. Every alcoholic in this room is uniquely qualified to help another alcoholic save their life. Priests, doctors, psychiatrists do not speak the language of the heart that we can speak to each other. The fourth step made me feel like I was part of the group. Pain is a great motivator. When the pain got bad enough, I wrote out my fourth step. I shared my fifth step with my sponsor. I remember at the end of it, he said to me, is that it? You know? And then it dawned on me, he was an ex-FBI narcotics agent. You can imagine what he did in his career. So I thought, I paled by comparison. But the truth of the matter is that there were things that I left out that years later I had to deal with. Painful, you know, to admit. The shame that's involved in this disease. The guilt, the remorse. We can get forgiveness, you know. We have to learn to love ourselves. The selfish part of this program. I've experienced love, loss, death. Four of my sponsees committed suicide. Brilliantly, horribly, you know, the anger. A lot of alcoholics take their lives, you know. And yet I've been fortunate enough to know men who shared their experience, strength, and hope with me that helped keep me sober and learn that I'm not alone, I'm not unique, you know. It's very quiet in here tonight. It's like, they say the truth is coming out when it gets real quiet. From the death of my heart and soul, I can never repay Alcoholics Anonymous. That I learned to care for other human beings. When I heard the line, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself, I thought, that's a bit much, you know. I couldn't look in the mirror for a long time. My sponsor said, look in the mirror and say, I love you. I went, oh. And I have to shave every day, like, I love you. You know? And he said to me, write this following statement out and put it on your refrigerator. I said, what now? Not guilty. Because I carried around the guilt and the shame. Growing up with alcoholism, experiencing neglect and abuse, not forgiving those people. And then eventually I had to get to that step where I made the amends. And I'll share with you tonight the one of my sons went with me to my father's grave. And his name is Joseph R. Daly, the same as mine. And it was a Christmas time. I was already sobbing on the way there. I'd called him up. I said, Justin, it's going to be pretty tough. Are you up for it? And he said, I'm up for it, Dad. We had these beautiful flowers. And we went to the grave, and I stood there. Justin stayed by the car for a few minutes, and I looked down and I said, I'm sorry. And the words kept coming out, I'm sorry, for all the anger, because in the end of the fourth step, it talks about our part in it. I could always justify my drinking because of other people's behavior or neglect, but I never wanted to admit my part in what went down. I certainly wasn't an easy kid. By anybody's definition, to live with, to deal with, and foster homes that we were in. And that moment I was freed, that I had a sense I could forgive him and forgive myself for my anger towards him, my resentment. We pay the price for carrying these resentments. You know, you'll see this if you go to enough meetings, you'll see those old timers that are still sitting there, angry. Why are you angry? You've been given the greatest gift of your life. Why are you angry? You know, because you haven't worked the program as outlined in this beautiful book. I often think of, I was always motivated to be successful at whatever I tried to do. I tried to be perfect at what I did. And I think of Bill Wilson going to Akron, Ohio. And if you ever give a thought, a few minutes of this, what if Bill Wilson was successful in his business trip? He stood in the lobby of that hotel looking at the joviality, the tinkling glasses with the ice cubes in it. It called him. Cersei was, come on over here. And he made that call. Had he been successful, I wouldn't be alive. Countless hundreds of thousands of people would not have lives transformed. This is a transformative program. Your life will be changed. It's not, when I read in the big book, it said, drinking is only a symptom. I thought, well, what the hell is the problem? I thought, if you just stop drinking. No. That's the beginning. That's the admission to a whole new life through prayer. You know, and every step of the way, I had to learn to get on my knees and ask, keep me sober today. At the end of the day, get on my knees and say thank you to what I didn't know. It was a tree outside the mustard seed. That was my first higher power. You know, there was a scraggly tree that every time I went there, I saw the trees, the leaves, you know, budding and then falling off the longer I was there. I spoke at the mustard seed last week. I'm happy to say that tree and my faith has grown considerably. The first positive emotion an alcoholic gets in recovery is hope. It starts with, maybe I don't have to drink. You see some guy or gal who has 27 days and you have 12 days. You think, if she can do it, I can do it. And then you do it. And you have the hope that maybe I can live a sober life, a life of dignity. That eventually leads to faith. And I've had to call on that faith many times in my recovery. 2 years ago, they said you have melanoma. The chance of your dying is pretty high. I'm here to tell you that they got it out. I've had many different operations over the years. When that phone call comes back, when they give you the biopsy report, you know, that's a moment, a discerning moment of truth, where I just turn, I say, thy will not mine be done. God, give me the strength to speak tonight. That is, some alcoholic is in this room and thinking, oh, maybe I'll go out tonight, just have a few. Maybe my voice, some of the words, you might take to heart and say, I'll give it another day. You can always drink tomorrow, just don't drink today. I belong to that club where you don't drink no matter what. You know. She leaves you, she breaks your heart, don't drink. IRS comes after you, says, please send everything back, Joe. You don't drink. They send you an enormous check, you don't drink. You learn to love and be loved and accept people's caring for you and respect. I used to wince at that, like the idea that people would respect me, like, you know, because the self-hatred was so strong, so long that I carried that burden. We can learn to shed the story. We could find an opportunity for new memories, joyful memories, to have faith. I know I could go speaking more. How many minutes do I have? 2 more minutes. This is the longest 30 minutes of my life. I don't know what else to say. I have 2 sons that are sitting here tonight, Nick and Justin. Never saw me drunk. I never saw my father sober. You know, this is a gift. Am I grateful? Yeah, beyond words. I fight back the tears, you know, tears of joy. I used to think I was a tough guy. My sons are reminding me, Dad, you cry at sunsets, you know. It's not over yet. The story is still to be told. With faith and trust in my higher power, with your help, I will continue to stay sober and carry the message to other alcoholics. When my sponsor said in the 4th step, and remember, Joe, write down some of your assets. I couldn't think of a thing to write. I thought, well, I dress well. It's a studied look, come on. I'm thrifty. I'm neat. I'm polite. I thought, you're a Boy Scout. You know, it's like, And then the voice came in and said, you have the ability to communicate to other alcoholics. And that's a gift that I've been given. You gave me that gift. I thank you for my life.